Today on the show, we are talking about the new ancient amphibian species Arena erpeton supinatus. This is fresh science. This is hot off the press. The paper describing this new fossil friend came out today. Honestly, it doesn't get much better than this. Pals in Paleo presents Arena erpeton with Lachlan Hart. Let's go back. This is Pals in Paleo, where we discuss the form, function, and family groupings of fossils with some of the coolest experts in the field. I'm your host, paleontologist, PhD student, and amphibian superfan Adele Pentland. You can follow me on Instagram at Pals in Paleo, and every now and then I do giveaways, but you've got to be in it to win it. So check us out at Pals in Paleo on Instagram, and Paleo is spelt P-A-L-A-E-O. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land throughout Australia, in particular the Darkindung people as well as the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I recognise First Nations people as the original scientists, engineers and technologists of this land and recognise their connections to land, sky, water and community. Pals in Paleo pays our respects to the elders past, present and emerging and extends that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today.
Beedle.
Hey, it's Adele coming in hot. I know there's a lot of science in this episode, and I want to make sure no one gets left behind when they listen to this, so I slapped together a quick glossary of some science words for you. We'll be talking about fossils from the Mesozoic period, which can be split into three: the Triassic, Jurassic, and Cretaceous periods. I've just listed them in order of oldest to youngest. And we also talk about the Permian period, which is immediately before the Triassic. So just keep that in mind when we're talking about the ages of things and how old they are. There's also a bunch of anatomical terms in this one. Most of the time, we're talking about the skull versus the rest of the body. So a headless skeleton is sometimes referred to as the postcranial skeleton. Last ones, I promise, relate to the head. So a mandible is another word for a lower jaw, which is also sometimes called a dentary. And the rest of the head, or the skull, is also called the cranium, which then links back to the whole post-cranial skeleton situation, post being after. Anyway, I hope that all makes sense, and hopefully that'll make things a little less confusing. Today, we are once again talking temnospondyls. And I know what you're thinking. Adele, we've already heard about temnospondyls, these weird ancient amphibians. And yeah, I realize Coolosuchus comes up in every other episode. You're probably sick to death of hearing me talk about them, but okay, just hear me out. So originally, I wanted my next amphibian to be Beelzebufo from the Cretaceous of Madagascar. You might be familiar with the so-called devil frog or demon toad if you've seen the second season of Prehistoric Planet. But I was at Paleo Down Under 3 at the early career casual hangout sesh, which was at a brewery, having a great time. And our guest on today's episode, Lachlan Hart, bumped into me, mentioned he'd listened to the episode on Coolosuchus. I also just want to shout out Isabella Donata, another awesome paleo at the University of Adelaide, who listens to the show and came up to me at PDU3. It really means a lot to me whenever someone says they listen to the show, let alone other paleos doing kick-ass science. But yeah, Lachlan and I were chatting away. He said a bunch of nice things about what he thought of the Coolosuchus episode, as well as something that needs fixing up, but more on that later. And he also wanted to see if I was keen to have him on to talk about the new temnospondyl he's been working on from the Triassic. And like, How could I say no? Not quite the same as someone offering to fully fund a dinosaur dig for an extra 3 years in exchange for a helicopter ride and signing off on some paperwork, but still pretty exciting. So yeah, anyway, that's a peek behind the curtain and glimpse into the chaotic behind the scenes of making the podcast. I'm really good at making plans, but terrible at following through sometimes. But the upside of talking about yet another Temnus Bondle is that we get to cover these ancient amphibians in a little bit more detail, including the fact that some Temnus Bondles had tusks, horns, and there's recorded evidence of cannibalism. On top of all that, it's a fossil with a surprising origin story, and you know I'm a sucker for that. I hope you're sufficiently psyched up for this killer interview with Lachlan, but before we get into all that, first things first, it's time for our random fossil fact. Now, if you want to keep up to date with the latest and greatest dinosaur research, you want to check out I Know Dino with Garrett and Sabrina. Or if recent advancements in evolutionary biology is more your thing, you tune into Common Descent. Meanwhile, here at Pals in Paleo, well, if we were a radio station, we'd be playing golden oldies. To me, finding a paper published 10 plus years ago on something kind of niche that's still really cool and relevant to today, I don't know, it's kind of like going to the op shop and you find an amazing book for like $5 and it's a first edition. Something about the thrill of the chase and combing through old stuff in search of treasure. It's very similar to being out on a dinosaur dig searching for fossils. You're on the lookout for these long lost relics. Sometimes you walk away empty handed, you don't find a single thing. Other times you hit the jackpot. Anyway, I'm sure you didn't tune into this episode to hear me talk about the parallels between paleontology and secondhand stores. No, you're here for facts on fossils. Today's random fossil fact is something I pulled from my conversation with Lachlan, and it's on Temnus Bondle cannibalism. There's a few recorded cases of this behavior, but today we're going to zoom in to talk about the extinct amphibian Apatheon gracilis. The evidence is pretty damning, by the way. There's literally bones of a small Apatheon in the gut of a larger individual. The paper describing this was published by Florian Weitzmann in 2009 in the journal Fossil Record, and as always, I'll chuck a link to that in the show notes, and that one's free to read too. Weitzmann noted that many modern amphibians eat members of their own species. Sometimes it's kind of common, other times it's brought on by a change in the seasons, but normally it's the eggs and larval stages that get picked on the most, which makes sense, right? They're the smallest and the easiest to catch. Just to provide a bit of background to Apatheon, it's a type of Temnus Bondle from the Permian of Germany and belongs to a group called the Branchiosaurids, and the adults grew as large as 15 centimeters from head to tail. So if you're not familiar with the metric system, that's half a foot long. They're not as big as the new Triassic Temnus Bondle we'll hear about later on this episode. They're just little. Some members of this group, the Branchiosaurids, are so well preserved that you can see what's going on with their gills. And it looks like their gills were set up to trap plankton swimming in the water and eat them during their teenage phase. The adults, though, were eating fish and, yeah, other Branchiosaurids, so this includes other species, and conspecifics too. Conspecifics is just a fancy word that means members of their own species or the same taxa. And like a lot of amphibians alive today, this particular species, Apatheon, went through metamorphosis. So the eggs would have been laid in water, and then there would have been an aquatic larval stage or tadpole phase, and then the adults lived on land. Pretty cool to think that this iconic life cycle has been going on for millions and millions of years. So yeah, in some groups of Temnus Bondles, their bodies went through some big changes throughout their life cycle, and as their bodies changed, they also switched up what they were eating as well. Here's the kicker though. Even after metamorphosis in adults of Apatheon, the teeth are kind of on the small side, they're delicate, and they're packed close together. So they're actually more suited for eating plankton and filter feeding. So the author was kind of surprised to find evidence of cannibalism in this particular species. The author of the paper, Florian Weitzman, noted that cannibalism in modern-day amphibians sometimes gets triggered by changes in the environment, the big one being when they're in a pond or a body of water, but then that dries out. This not only pushes whatever's still living in that water together, but there's less food available too, so all of a sudden, friends or family become food. There's also been instances where these bone beds are discovered and they're just jam-packed full of fossil amphibians that all died out at the same time. Obviously very tragic, but they do make great fossils. But yeah, I heard Lachlan mention that during our conversation, just very casually, that temnospondyls were cannibals, or at least some were, and I just had to learn more. That's not even the weirdest thing about them, though. Like, not even close. I learned heaps when I was chatting with him, and I think you will too. So let's go back in time and explore some Triassic temnospondyls and learn about Australia's newest fossil amphibian. For today's episode, I have a really special guest, fellow PhD candidate, Lachlan Hart. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. How are you? Thanks for having me.
No worries. Thank you so much for making time. I chaotically decided at the last minute that recording today as a spur of the moment thing would be an absolutely great idea. And I'm so lucky that you decided to accept the invitation. You're currently a PhD candidate at the University of New South Wales.
That's right. Yeah, at UNSW and jointly the Australian Museum as well.
Yep. So you're supervised by Dr. Matt McCurry?
I am. That's pretty much it. I've actually been really blessed because of COVID-related things. I've had a few changes to my supervisory panel over my PhD tenure, but Matt has been the one constant through the whole thing, which is really good because he's the one that knows the most about my project.
Yep. And before we hit record, we were chatting before. So did he already have this project sort of lined up? We're here to talk about a very special new temnospondyl, an ancient amphibian, but you've also worked on fossil crocs before.
So I was finishing off my master's thesis at UNE and I was coming towards the end of that and I was thinking what I was going to do next. And so I'm originally from Sydney and I was living up in Armidale to do the master's and I thought I'd really like to move back to Sydney to be with family. And so I contacted Matt at the museum and I asked if he had any PhD kind of projects in mind that a student could do. And yeah, he said, well, what do you want to work on? I'm like, well, I've worked on crocs before. I'd like to continue working on Mesozoic stuff as possible, but it doesn't have to be crocs. And he said, well, you know, we don't have that much croc material, but what we do have is some really great temnospondyl material. I'm like, that sounds interesting. I hadn't really worked much on temnospondyls before. I mean, I knew what they were, but I hadn't worked intensely on them. So that was kind of how it came about as a challenge to get my head around all the taxonomy and the literature of another brand new group after I just spent 3 years learning all about ancient crocodiles. And yeah, and one of the projects that Matt had in mind, in fact, the very first project that Matt had in mind for me to work on was this new fossil that we're going to talk about today.
Yeah, I should say for anyone who hasn't listened to the episode on Coolosuchus, temnospondyls are ancient amphibians. Their body plan is kind of similar to a croc, would that be fair to say?
Yeah, so I've heard them described as being a bit of a mix between a crocodile and a giant salamander. Their postcranial skeleton definitely looks more crocish. So the variation that we see in temnospondyls is in their skulls. So that's where we see the most difference. So there are some that have heads that look a lot like crocodiles. So animals like Parasyclotosaurus and Eriops had very long skulls like crocodiles. And then there's other ones like Coolosuchus that had more parabolic brevirostron skulls like a giant salamander would.
So yeah, sort of quadrupedal, so four legs, sprawled out and long tails, but then the heads are quite distinct from species to species, but there are a few things that unite them, one being ornamentation in the skull. So instead of just smooth bone surface, it's a crazy sort of pattern.
Yeah, kind of wrinkly looking. It's very distinct. Once you see a couple of them, it's very easy to kind of pick out temnospondyl skull bone because of that very wrinkly looking texture. They also have sensory canals that kind of go deep into the roof of the skull, which is kind of cool, which they probably use for sensing stuff when they're swimming around in the water.
So able to detect electric currents and like the movements of the muscles of other animals around them?
Yeah, potentially kind of analogous to what sharks can do today. They've got that that
ampullae of Lorenzini.
That one, yeah. The ampullae of Lorenzini, the sixth sense that sharks have. So it's kind of analogous to that, or maybe even more like something that I think a platypus has something similar as well, where they have these, it's like sensory perception when they're in the water, because they're fairly blind. And so they use these different sensory things to kind of feel their way around when they're foraging for food in the water. So yeah, tennis bottles perhaps use theirs in a very similar way, although I think their eyesight may have been probably a bit better than a platypus.
Yeah, I suppose with temnospondyls as well, their eyes aren't sort of facing forward in line with their jaws. Are they kind of like looking upwards at the water above them a lot of the time?
Yeah, so again, this is another variation in between species of temnospondyls. Some have their eyes really close to the front of their snout. Some have them really close to the back of their head. Some have them kind of at the midline. Some, the eyes have kind of migrated down towards the side. So a bit like what you might see in a dinosaur with the eyes on the sides. But yeah, with a lot of them, the eyes are kind of placed on the top of their head. So like modern amphibians like frogs and salamanders do, or some salamanders, not all. Maybe frogs is a better analogy, but most frogs have the eyes kind of plopped right on the top of their heads. And then they can look up when they're in the water and they can just kind of poke their head up a bit and their eyes are kind of poking out. There's evidence by looking at temnospondyl skulls that there were quite a lot of muscle attachments to the bottom of the eye. So they were probably able to kind of pull their eyes like down a fair bit into their skulls.
Is that to help with eating or not?
I don't know. Maybe it was more of a protection thing. But yeah, a lot of them had like quite a large muscle attachment point for the eye stalk, which is interesting.
Yeah, that's absolutely wild and something that I don't really think about in terms of looking at a fossil skull. Oh, I wonder how far it can retract its eyeballs.
Yeah.
But I say that because I work on pterosaurs and it's just not a consideration.
Yeah, so apparently into their mouth.
That's what I've heard with frogs. That fact still haunts me today.
Yeah, so they were very weird animals.
Yeah, and I feel like Australia as well, because the fossil record here is more extensive than it is in other places around the world, it just stands out more as being even weirder.
Yeah, so Australia is really weird because temnospondyls were actually around before the dinosaurs. They arose during the Carboniferous period, but they really had their heyday in most places in the world except Australia during the Permian period. And at the end of the period, as a lot of people know, that's when we had the biggest mass extinction that ever occurred in Earth's history, like over 90% of living things died or something during the Great Dying. But temnospondyls survived it. They're one of the few vertebrate groups that actually survived that end Permian mass extinction event. Prior to that, there's hardly any record of them at all in Australia. And then after the Permian extinction event, so the next period is the Triassic. In the Triassic, they're going bananas. You're tripping over temnospondyls in Australia in the Triassic. In fact, we don't find much else in Australia but temnospondyls in Triassic terrestrial strata, which is very odd.
I feel like Australia will sometimes just be late to catch on to a trend, starting back with the temnospondyls.
Yeah.
So Australia's kind of noteworthy because, well, Cyderops was found in, I'm going to say the 60s. I'm not sure if that's right.
1983, it was finally described. I think the fossils, they would have been found before that, though. Because it's a complete skeleton, near complete skeleton, especially back then, it took quite a long time to work on describing things because they didn't have all the fancy computer technology and high-quality photographs and 3D stuff that we have today. There's a lot more old-fashioned paleontology.
Probably would have had to write their manuscripts on a typewriter and then mail it to the editor.
Yeah, and the level of detail in the illustrations in those old manuscripts, that blows my mind. I'm a very bad artist. I can't draw very well. And so when I see the drawings that these paleontologists did in these papers that I'm reading, I'm like, wow, like I couldn't ever draw anything this accurate to this amount of detail.
Yeah, no, I feel exactly the same way. That level of, I guess, understanding of the anatomy as well, but some of them look better than photos, to be honest.
Yeah, they are.
So Cyderops is from the Jurassic of Queensland.
Yep.
Which was really weird because Temnus spondyls were thought to have been basically completely wiped out at that point?
Yeah, so even though they survived the end Permian extinction, it was believed that they probably died out at the end of the Triassic. There was no evidence of them at all surviving the end Triassic extinction, which was still an extinction event, just not quite as major as the end Permian one. Then they found Siderops in not even the earliest Jurassic sediments in Queensland. It's kind of early mid-Jurassic sediments in Queensland, which is just insane. As I said, it's a near complete skeleton, and they thought, well, this had to be the last one. This really weird one just came and survived into the Jurassic. And then not long after that, it was like, here's a challenge to the rest of the world. And they actually found other Temnus spondyl fossils that were even younger than Siderops in Southeast Asia. Then they thought, well, okay, these had to be the last ones. And then, as your listeners would know, Coolosuchus popped up. And finding Coolosuchus in early Cretaceous sediments in Victoria, I read somewhere, I think it was Tom Rich, that compared it to, it'd be almost the same as finding a Tyrannosaurus rex alive today, because there is literally a 60 million year age gap between Siderops and Coolosuchus, which is almost the same age gap between T-Rex and us. So that's what puts it into a bit more perspective.
I had never heard it described that way, but that is, it's hurting my head a little bit, and I love it, but oh my gosh. So in Australia, we've got Triassic, Jurassic, Cretaceous, Temnus spondyls. They've been found in Victoria, as we said, with Coolosuchus, in Queensland with Siderops. Before you started your PhD, how much did we know about Temnus spondyls in New South Wales?
Not too much compared to what we know about, especially the Queensland Temnus spondyls, because that's where we find the majority of our Triassic Temnus spondyl fossils, particularly in a place called the Crater, which is kind of, I'm going to say kind of central west Queensland, but I might be wrong. Your Queensland listeners will probably correct me. But yeah, so it's the Arcadia Formation.
Everyone has a different definition of what's central Queensland and what's western Queensland. Let's not get into it.
Queensland. Somewhere in the outback of Queensland is this really great place where they found lots of Temnus spondyls. And the only Temnus spondyl that we know of from Victoria is Coolosuchus. There's a couple known from Western Australia as well. But as far as New South Wales stuff goes, there was one juvenile Temnus spondyl fossil found from the Central Coast. There's one isolated jaw from an enormous one called Bogosuchus, which was found at Long Reef, which is kind of on the coast, not far from the centre of Sydney. And then there was this other one, which I mentioned a little while ago, called Paracyclodosaurus, which was an enormous crocodile-shaped Temnus spondyl that was found in the early 1900s. And then the holotype of that was shipped off to the British Museum of Natural History, because that's what they used to do back then. So we don't even have it, but we have the cast of it.
Do they still have it?
Yep, they still got it.
Okay. I know with pterosaur fossils, sometimes stuff was sent out in the mail and then no one knows where it is. It was lost in the post.
Yeah, look, they couldn't have posted this because the holotype was these massive ironstone nodules that they found in a brick pit in St. Peter's, which is one of the suburbs of Sydney. You can still see it on display at the British Museum of Natural History, actually. They cast out the skeleton out of like the natural mold that was inside those ironstone nodules, and they put it on display. It's this massive crocodile-looking Temnus spondyl. So that's pretty much it as far as Temnus spondyl taxa from New South Wales goes. And nothing kind of linking it to the Temnus spondyls that persisted right through to the end. So Siderops and Coolosuchus are both members of a Temnus spondyl family called Chigutosaurs, and we had nothing in New South Wales that was kind of linking the whole family history of these late survivors together.
So attempts to try and throw together the Temnus spondyls, the Australian record in phylogenetic analyses, because there wasn't many fossils, was it difficult?
Not particularly difficult, because we still have a good record of this particular family that we're talking about from other places in Gondwana. So there's a number of species known from both South America and India that kind of, at that point, were tying the whole story together. But it was still weird that we didn't have anything known from New South Wales.
I really do want to talk about this new Temnus spondyl, which you presented at Paleodown Under 3. It was amazing. I had to follow you presenting as well, which was kind of nerve-wracking because it was like, ah, oh my God, how am I going to top this? Such a good presentation.
Thank you.
But you also published on a isolated tooth from Talbragar. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. So that was the very first paper I got out of my PhD. And that was part of tying this whole story together. So the fossil fish beds of Talbragar are a really known fossil site in New South Wales. They're one of the few Jurassic deposits that we have. But previously, all they're pulled out of there, as far as vertebrates go, are fish. And that's why they're called the fossil fish beds. And this site has been excavated for over 130 years. And this is by museum people and fossickers and amateur collectors. Yeah, so they were pretty certain that they weren't going to find anything else besides fish and insects and plants there. And then a few years ago, on a routine fossil trip out there, one of the dig team found this little tooth. And it caught the eye of the others there. And they thought, oh, that doesn't really look like any of the fish teeth that we have seen from the fish that we know from Talbragar. And Matt collected it and put it into the museum collection. And then I started my PhD and said, hey, do you want to work on this? I don't think it's a fish tooth. Can we have a look and see what it is? So we got it micro CT scanned. It's tiny. The actual tooth is about the size of half of your pinky nail. So yeah, so we micro CT'd it and it turned out that it had this characteristic enamel pattern that we see in tennis bundles. So there's an enamel pattern called plicidentine, which is the infolding of the external enamel of the tooth that gives tennis bundles what is quite characteristic of them. In fact, it's what gave them their original taxonomic name, because they used to be called the brinthodonts, referring to the labyrinthine infolding of this enamel. Yeah, so I saw this in these micro CT images at different slices as well in this one little tooth. I'm like, that's a tennis bundle tooth. So we found a tennis bundle tooth in these Jurassic sediments that people didn't think there was any tetrapods in at all. So yeah, it was a cool little tooth and cool little story that kind of fit really neatly within my whole PhD, which is very lucky.
Yeah, it's crazy to think that after 130 years of excavations by so many different people, a site can still have its secrets.
Yeah, and like, it was a bit funny trying to work out how this one, it's not even the entire tooth, it's the crown of the tooth. And so this one little broken tooth, how did it even get there in the first place?
Because tennis bundles don't shed their teeth, do they?
Yeah, they do. They do, actually.
Okay. I thought I remembered something about the teeth aren't in sockets, but I could also be misremembering.
They're not technically in sockets, but they have like tooth growth that's kind of alternating. So every time they have a set of teeth that's in their jaw, they have a second set that's kind of pushing through and the original set fall out.
Yeah, it's still replacing old teeth with new teeth. It's just more like a conveyor belt, but it's still ensuring that there aren't big gaps in the teeth because prey might then be able to escape if there's a large enough gap. That makes sense. But then do they also have denticles on the roof of the mouth?
Yeah, some do. And some also have really large fangs in the roof of their mouth, or tusks, sometimes they call them. And some of these could be as big as your thumb.
Why?
Catching fish, maybe. I don't know. Some even had them like in their lower jaws. So they had these big tusks pointing upwards that grew so large in some species that when they closed their mouth, the only place that these upward facing tusks could go was through their nostrils when they shut their mouth.
That seems really counterproductive.
Yeah, so they're closing their mouth. And yeah, that was something I learned when I first learned about tennis bundles, that they had these really unusual teeth.
I knew they were weird, but it's good to talk to you because you actually know your stuff. But my gosh, like they just get weirder and weirder. Anyway, I guess that's part of their mystery and their charm.
Yeah, they're very strange. They're an extinct group that does have living relatives in living amphibians. But what we see in living amphibians is so far removed from what tennis bundles were that it's hard to make inferences based on what we see in living amphibians, and it's hard to find appropriate analogs for what we're looking at. For example, like if you're looking at theropods and you want to look at theropod feet, you can go and look at an emu or a cassowary's feet because they're still theropod feet. But the modern frogs and salamanders don't have tusks.
Honestly, tusk was not on my bingo card of words to pop up in today's interview.
Yeah, you learned something today.
Yep. Okay, let's just get into it. This new Temnus bundle, it was discovered by accident.
Yes.
And it's sort of the finale for your PhD.
Yeah, so as I said, it was like the first project I got, and it's basically the last thing I'm working on before I submit my PhD. So it took quite a long time for me to work on this, and I wasn't the first person to look at it either. when it was first discovered in 1997, a whole bunch of scientists have looked at it since then and just haven't had the time to work on it and, you know, describe it fully. And so I was lucky enough to get to work on it. But yeah, it was discovered by accident. A man who was a retired chicken farmer bought a bunch of rocks from the local quarry at Kincumber on the central coast of New South Wales to build a retaining wall at his house. And he turned up one of these rocks and hosed off the mud, and this nearly complete skeleton of an amphibian was just sitting there.
That's absolutely wild. So you sort of touched on before, like, other people had tried to work on it. Did more preparation need to be done to the specimen before the science could happen, or?
Yeah, apparently the original block that was in was over a ton. So very heavy, but the fossil wasn't spread across that entire face of that block. And so it was cut down with a rock saw. It's still very heavy. It still weighs 300 kilos. I've never tried to lift it myself, and I don't want to because I don't want to get a hernia. But yeah, still very heavy, very dense sandstone, and very hard to manually prep. So I tried to manually prepare the fossil when I first started working on it. And if you look at the photos of the fossil, you can see these white lines, this kind of white halo around some of the fossil where I've tried to attack it with a prep tool, but it just wouldn't prep.
You've made your mark.
I made my mark on it. Yeah, it just wouldn't prep. I'm not a sedimentologist or anything like that, but I think something to do with maybe the density.
It sounds like there could be a chemical cement binding the sand grains together. But yeah, in terms of it not separating nicely from the bone, there could be a density or a lack of density contrast between the fossil and the surrounding sandstone. That's my guess anyway. I'm not a sedimentologist either.
Yeah, that was my educated guess. And I spoke to a few other people who knew more about it than I did, and they kind of agreed with me. And that was actually confirmed even more so. So after the manual prep was a bit of a fail, we decided, well, let's try to get this thing x-rayed. So we took it to a covert x-ray facility. We got special permission that would never be granted to anybody again. And we used high-powered x-ray scanners that are normally reserved for the scanning of shipping cargo to see if we could penetrate the fossil with those x-ray beams and see the details. So one thing I didn't mention is that the fossil is lying on its back.
So you're kind of looking at it on its belly, and then it's on its back, so you can't see its back.
Yeah, or the top of its head, or its eyes, or any of these sutures of the skull, which most vertebrate paleontologists will tell you that they're some of the most important features in the skull of any vertebrate for diagnostic reasons. Yeah, so we took it to this x-ray facility and we attempted to get x-ray scans, but just like we have with the manual prep, very little definition between the bone and the matrix that was surrounding it. So I was kind of left to take some good photos of it and draw some lines around what I thought the bones were and describe it from there.
So if the prepped block is now 300 kilos, which would be about 660 pounds, how big is the fossil within that?
From the nose of the fossil, or the end of the snout, to what's preserved is about 94 centimetres. It's missing its tail, so it would have been over a metre long when it was complete.
So it's about 3.3 feet long. So not a massive animal, but still pretty sizable.
Yeah, I mean, there are Chinese giant salamanders that are kind of in the same size range as far as length goes. But one really cool thing about this one is that because it's on its back, we can see its ribs. So we can kind of see how thick or heavy set it was. And just by looking at the ribs, we can see there's a much more robust animal than a giant salamander. And the other thing that we can kind of look at and make inferences about how thick it was is that we have, it's actually the outlines of soft tissue.
That's absolutely mind-blowing. I had never considered that you could get soft tissue preservation in sandstone. I don't know why, but for some reason, I just thought it was a limestone concretion thing.
Yeah, I mean, again, I don't know the geochemistry behind it. I just know that I look at the fossil and I see this nice shadowy black outline around the ribs, and there's a little bit in the head, and there's a little bit kind of around one of the hands that we have preserved. And yeah, that's all soft tissue. And so we can kind of have a look at it and say, well, this is the extent of the rib, and this is the extent of the soft tissue, which extends quite a fair way away from the ribs, which can kind of tell us a couple of things. One thing it can tell us is that that's maybe how fat the animal was in real life. Maybe he was just kind of plump. Or it can tell us that perhaps after the animal died, the corpse was subject to bloating, like a lot of things do when they die. And so because it bloated, that would have stretched out its skin and its fatty tissues surrounding the body a little bit further.
Yeah, so I should also say, so the soft tissue is sort of like a black kind of gunky color, but the bone, I'm guessing, is like a whitish color.
Yeah, most of it. Some of the bone is, especially in the head, some of the bone is not preserved as clearly as the ribs and some of the vertebrae are, which again made trying to work out what bones were what in the skull very difficult. It's also crushed. The skull is quite crushed. Again, making description a bit of a challenge, Adele.
It's funny, sometimes I'll be working with one isolated bone, trying to figure out where it fits in an animal's body and kind of be wishing I had something more complete to work with. But the more material you have, I guess, the more the pressure's on to try and do something with everything that you have. And when the best x-ray scanner in the country doesn't work, well, yeah, you just kind of have to do what you can with the fossil that you have.
Yeah, and especially with this one. So when it was first discovered, it caused a bit of a media frenzy. It was in about 20 different newspapers around the world, the New South Wales Premier calling it a national treasure. It generated a lot of public interest. They even put it on display at something called the Dinosaur World Tour, which was this Canadian touring dinosaur exhibit that just happened to be in Sydney at the start of 1997 when they found the fossil. And so, yeah, they put it on display there, and I actually went there as a young kid with my parents and my little brother. So I would have seen that fossil. And then more than 20 years later, I ended up working on it for my PhD.
I forgot to ask you this at the start because we immediately just started talking temnospondyls. But when you were younger, did you want to be a paleontologist when you grew up?
I did. It crossed my mind and out of my mouth every day of my life when I was a young kid. So I was obsessed with dinosaurs from an early age. I'm a pre-Jurassic Park baby. And so I was obsessed with dinosaurs before Jurassic Park. And then it came out and then everyone was like, oh yeah, we like dinosaurs too. So then I wasn't so weird. Yeah, I wanted to be a paleontologist. And then I finished primary school, went into high school and found out that being a paleontologist and liking dinosaurs and stuff like that wasn't a very cool thing to do. And so I kind of pursued other avenues of interest like music and stuff like that for a little while. And when I finished high school, I went into teaching. So I did a teaching degree and I was a primary school teacher for over a decade.
So then what lured you back into the world of paleontology?
I don't know exactly what the trigger was that made me think, you know what, I really should go back and chase my original dreams and live what I wanted to live. And maybe I was there in the classroom every day telling my students, whatever you want to do, you can achieve it. And I'm standing there thinking, well, when I was your age, I wanted to do something that's not what I'm doing now. Then I made the decision to start studying again. Initially, I did it part-time while I was still teaching. And then eventually I had to give up being in the classroom altogether to pursue research and paleo as a more full-time pursuit.
At that stage, was that when you started doing your master's at University of New England?
I was still teaching in the classroom for a little while I was doing my master's. I was doing that kind of part-time and doing my master's part-time, and then gave up fully once I started the PhD.
So you study full-time and get a stipend and all those good things?
All those good things. I also work part-time at the Australian Museum and I teach in the School of Education at UNE as well.
Awesome. What's your role with the Australian Museum?
I'm a technical officer in paleontology, and the project that I'm on is actually working on something that's completely removed from my PhD, which is good because that means it doesn't affect my stipend. and I'm working on the McGrath's Flat deposit, which is a Miocene Larga Strata that was recently discovered not too far from where the Tarabra site is, actually.
Yeah. Did that come out this year sometime?
I think it was maybe the very start of last year, the original site description paper. And there's been a few more papers leaning on from that, describing the new species of fossil insects and spiders and stuff that have come from there.
Oh, yeah, the spiders are spectacular. I'm an arachnophobe. I freak out whenever I see like a big hairy spider. I can look at a redback and be like, don't touch. But yeah, even I have to admit, they're stunning fossils.
Yeah, so I'm pretty lucky that that's the job I get to do when I'm not thinking about temnospondyls. I get to sort out fossil insects and go and smash rocks and find new ones inside rocks.
Yeah, that's awesome. Getting back to temnospondyls, we've been talking about this incredible new specimen in sandstone from the Kincumber Quarry. How does it stack up compared to some of the other temnos from Australia? Do you think it's a new species?
Yes, it is a new species. Am I allowed to name my new species right now, or are we...
Yeah, I reckon. Go for it.
Okay, so we're going to call... It's a new genus and new species, actually. So the genus name is Arena erpeton.
As of this recording, the paper isn't out yet, but I will be good. I'll wait and do everything right and wait until embargo. I feel like I get to play journalist. Like, this is very exciting for me to have an exclusive. Not an exclusive, but...
This is the first time we're talking about it, so this is fantastic. Yeah, so we're calling it Arena erpeton, which means sand creeper, referring to the sandstone block in which it was found. And the species name is supinatus, which means lying on its back, because, as I explained, the fossil is lying on its back. So yeah, Arena erpeton supinatus is going to be the official name for the Kingcumber retaining wall amphibian.
The Kingcumber retaining wall amphibian is also like a great name.
It is.
But Arena erpeton, it's fitting that such a spectacular fossil that generated so much hype when it was initially found will finally have a scientific name, have its moment in the sun, as it were, and it'll be put on public display as well.
Yeah, so the Australian Museum have had it in their collection since 1997, and now that it's finally been described and named towards the end of this year, around December-ish, they're saying that it's going to go onto display in the museum so people can come and have a look at it and, yeah, just marvel at this amazing fossil that I got to work with.
And you're obviously going to see it when it's on display. You're going to get a photo with it.
Absolutely, I'll get a photo with it, just like I got a photo with my family walking into the dinosaur world tour all those years ago. I'll recreate the photo with my little brother and we'll do it again. It's going to be a special moment for me. I went to the Australian Museum all the time as a child growing up in Sydney, and to have a fossil that I actually named and described to be on display there is just, it's something else.
It's really cool when you get to have that moment of knowing you've made your mark in paleontology and, I guess, being part of inspiring the next generation of paleontologists as well. Who knows, there could be kids that see the fossil and in 20, 30 years' time, maybe there will be an X-ray scan and that will be powerful enough to see the dorsal surface. You know, there's a whole world of possibilities.
Yeah, and they'll be able to describe it better than I ever did. And that's great, because science is self-correcting and that's what we want to do. You know, every time we put something forward, it's a hypothesis. I'm hypothesizing that this is the new species and this is what the anatomical details that I can see, this is what they tell us. When we can see more of what's hidden in that rock, then I'm sure they'll learn more about this pretty amazing animal.
I'm sure there'll also be people who study soft tissue preservation that will be clamoring to work on this as well. You mentioned that there's a little bit of soft tissue around the torso area as well as the hand. I'm pretty sure I know the answer to this from your talk at PDU3, but does it have webbed hands?
So we can't see that much, unfortunately.
No.
I like to think that most Temnus bottles did have webbed hands because...
Makes sense.
Especially the ones that lived from the Triassic onwards spent most of their time in the water. The ones that lived prior to that during the Permian, animals like Eriops, spent more time on the land. But most post-Permian Temnus bottles were more obligately aquatic.
So if they're spending most of their time in water, I'm guessing a lot of amphibians, they would reproduce in the water. Does that mean they would also be hunting in the water as well, you reckon?
Yeah, so the really cool artist reconstruction of Arena erpeton that we got done has it chasing common fish from the Sydney Basin called Clyphe relipus. So that's probably what most Temnus bottles are doing, hunting fish or other small prey. There's evidence of cannibalism in Temnus bottles, eating the larval forms of even the same species, basically hunting down anything that was smaller than them in the water.
That's very on brand for amphibians. I think I can't remember what species it is off the top of my head, but I know there's one species of frog and the dads have the babies in their mouth, but if they want to mate with another female, they just swallow their babies to get them out of the way. It's absolutely brutal.
That's gnarly. That's great. Yeah, amphibians are, they're not going to win any Parent of the Year awards. Let's put it that way.
So the new paper describing Irina Erpeton, I'm assuming your PhD supervisor, Matt McCurry, is a co-author on the paper. Is there anyone else who helped you with it?
Yeah, so the project was given to me by Matt and he helped me through the whole process. And so, yeah, definitely thanks to Matt for that. But also we had Brian G, who is not based in Australia, he's based in North America, who is pretty much like one of the world experts in tendinous bundles, who was really helpful in helping me work out some of those finer details of the anatomy and the phylogeny. And also Pat Smith from the Australian Museum as well. He doesn't work on vertebrates, but now I'm teasing him saying he's actually a vertebrate paleontologist now because he's got a paper coming out in the Journal of Vertebrate Paleontology. Pat's a trilobite guy, loves his trilobites, but he's also a very good biostratigrapher and he's got quite a good brain for geology. And so Pat was really helpful just kind of working out what was going on geologically with the Irina Erpeton specimen.
Yeah, so it was discovered accidentally. In terms of actually figuring out specifically where it came from, it wasn't really an easy task.
So they don't know exactly where in the quarry the rock came from. And they never found the other half, the counterpart to the fossil. So they can only kind of guess. But from what Patrick could see and he explained to me when we looked at the fossil is that there's a fair bit of information in it that kind of can tell us a little bit more about how the fossil was deposited. Of course, there's quartz sand in it because that's sandstone, but there's alternating intervals of carbonized fossil plant material in it. And that combined with like no real cross bedding in the fossil, low grain size, sharper grain angles, all that type of stuff kind of tells us it's probably a low energy environment. It's just not traveling down a really fast stream.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense because even though the skull is crushed, the animal is in life position or in situ, and the vertebrae, the bones that make up the spine, they're just one after the other.
Yeah, and the ribs. So the vertebrae and the ribs and part of one of the big bones in the chest called the interclavicle, they're all as they would have been in life. Anyway, that all came from the brain of Patrick Smith. He's pretty good with that type of stuff. I'll also give a shout out to our paleo artist. We mentioned the paleo art before. So our artist's name is Jose Vitor Silva. He's a Brazilian paleo artist. He's done some art for me before. The last two pieces of art that I had commissioned, Vitor did those ones as well for me, which were when I described...
The first one being Isis Fortia Molneri?
Yeah, the Isis Fortia Molneri. So he did that one.
That's the croc.
Yeah, that's the croc. Other one was he did a piece of art for the last paper I put out. We investigated body mass estimation techniques in tendinous bundles. And so he did this really cool artwork of two fat tendinous bundles sitting on a balance scale because we were kind of estimating their mass. So yeah, he's a really great artist and easy to work with. And yeah, hopefully his artist's reconstruction will go up next to the fossil in the museum when it goes on display as well, which would be fantastic.
You'd be crazy not to. It's stunning, and I've said this before in other conversations with friends, nothing makes fossils come to life like good paleo art.
Yeah, that's true. And one really clever thing about this piece of art is that when you see it, it shows the underside of the animal. And as you remember from the earlier discussion, the fossil is only preserved from the belly up. And so instead of guessing about what the top of the animal looked like, if it had horns or what its dermal ornamentation might have looked like.
Oh, my God, I forgot they had horns.
Oh, yeah, they had horns. But we don't know if Irina Erpeton had horns. So because of that, there's a really clever piece of paleo art because we just see it from the belly up as we see the fossil. So we're not making any inferences that aren't there.
We had a little bit of a conversation at Paleodent Under 3 because you actually listened to the Coolosuchus episode. And when you said that, part of me was like, yay, but also, oh no, because I'm not an expert in temnus spondyls. You said something to the effect that Coolosuchus probably wasn't eating dinosaurs.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely wasn't ambushing dinosaurs, in my opinion. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that Coolosuchus and other broad-headed tendinous bundles, ones that had heads that are very similar in shape to modern giant salamanders, were actually suction feeding their prey, because that's what modern giant salamanders do.
So I don't think we've touched on suction feeding on the podcast before, but my understanding is that by opening the mouth really quickly, that then creates a vacuum and it kind of sucks food towards it. Does that kind of sound right?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. So it's been observed in some tendinous bundles that we have really good mandible and cranial fossils that from what we can see from the muscle attachments is that they didn't swing their jaws downwards like most other animals do when they open their mouth. They actually swung their cranium upwards. And so that's why a lot of us that work on tennis bundles refer to them as having heads like toilet seats. Because if you imagine how a toilet seat opens...
Oh, I thought it was a shape thing.
It's also a shape thing, but it's also the swinging of the lid.
I never made that connection.
Because a lot of them, their heads were quite thin comparatively, so not very deep skulled.
Kind of pancakey.
Yeah, kind of pancakey, like a big broad toilet seat. And so it's lifting up the toilet seat from the top and leaving the mandible underneath, which had, like I said, those gnarly fangs and tusks and stuff ready to catch anything that went in there. And yeah, because it's lifting up this really broad sheet of bone and skull upwards, that's creating that vacuum that's sucking things into its mouth as it's eating.
That's absolutely nuts and wild. If we go back in a time machine, we don't have to worry about Arena Opiton or Coolosuchus potentially eating us because the physics just wouldn't work.
Yeah, look, I probably still wouldn't go swimming with one. Those teeth still kind of scary.
I bet they would have some sort of mouth bacteria.
Oh yeah, for sure. And probably kind of slimy and...
They could be toxic as well.
It's in their family tree, right? So they potentially could have had venom glands or anything like that. Like, who knows? That type of stuff doesn't fossilize.
You've got soft tissue there. That's your next project.
Yeah. But regardless, I wouldn't go swimming around if there's 3.5 meter long amphibian with the head the size of a garbage bin lid. It just doesn't sound like a place I'd want to be. They can tell you that they're placid and they're not going to bite you, but you still don't want to stick your foot in the water to find out, do you?
Anything with a mouth can bite you, essentially.
Yeah. And look, just because they were feeding by suction doesn't mean that they couldn't bite things the normal way either. Just have like a little nibble, see if it tastes any good. Although I don't think they're too picky.
In terms of taxonomy, Arena Opiton, it seems that it's actually not that closely related to Siderops, which to me was surprising because even though at this point in time, Australia is still part of the big supercontinent Gondwana, I'm still kind of assuming, oh, well, the ones in New South Wales, surely they would be closely related to the ones in Queensland or failing that, Victoria. But it also seems that that might not be the case.
Yeah, so it's still within the same like general family group, the Chigurosaurs, as Siderops and also Coolosuchus, who are hypothesized to be quite closely related. But it is more closely related to a couple of taxa from South America and India. So there's an tennis model called Cardicephalus from India and one called Compsocerops, which is from Brazil. And they're the two closest relatives to Arena Opiton. Now, when I first saw that and saw that it wasn't that closely related to Siderops, I was also very confused. I'm like, oh, hang on, what's going on here? But then when you think about it in the whole big picture, this thing was living in the Triassic period as part of Gondwana, and so were these other two that I just mentioned, the ones from Brazil and from India. And so it's closely related to the animals from the same family that were living at the same time. There was some sort of divergence that happened in the group that eventually sprung Siderops and Coolosuchus, I guess.
Yep, so Siderops and Coolosuchus are still closely related to one another, according to your analysis? Or did, like, Arena Opiton kind of shake things up a little bit in terms of other related taxa?
It didn't shake things up too much. The problem with Coolosuchus is that we can't really put it into any kind of phylogenetic analysis because there isn't that much known of it. So the holotype of Coolosuchus is more or less just a mandible. There's been no described cranial material of Coolosuchus at all. There's a few little postcranial bits and pieces that were described at the same time as the mandible, but they're not very taxonomically informative. And so that's a bit of a problem with Coolosuchus, is that you can't really put it reliably into any phylogenetic analysis without the entire analysis having a heart attack. But Siderops we can. As I mentioned, Siderops is like a near complete skeleton. And so that's included in a lot of analyses of tennis bundles. When I put Arena Opiton into it, yeah, it didn't shake things up too much. We still have what we hypothesized originally as the most basal or most ancient member of that family group, which is also from Australia. It's one of the Triassic ones from Queensland, an animal called Caratobrachiops. And then apart from that, it hasn't actually stuffed things up too much.
Well, that's nice. Nice change of pace for an Australian fossil to not cause the phylogenetic analysis to have a heart attack. I know that that has sometimes been the case with ornithopod dinosaurs come to mind because it's quite basal and quite early branching. But yeah, nice to hear.
Yeah, even like Mudabarosaurus is still a bit of a weirdo, isn't it? Amongst all like ornithopods, which is kind of strange.
Yeah.
Because like, yeah, we have great material of it.
Yeah, I believe there's, off the top of my head, there's the holotype, there's preferred specimens as well. We were talking before we hit record, just about every museum in Australia has a cast of Mudabarosaurus. Like, I technically live closer to Mudabara than I do to Winton. Don't tell anyone I said that. It's a very well-guarded secret. But when I went down to Tasmania with my mum and there was a Mudabarosaurus on display, I was like, what are you doing here? I've traveled thousands of kilometers to see my neighbor. What's going on?
Yeah, and it's a bit of a weirdo because they still can't like place it properly phylogenetically, I think. And that's odd to me because, like we mentioned, it's got really great material. Sometimes the other issue with a lot of these Australian prehistoric animals that we put into these analyses is that the material is really isolated and not very diagnostic. There are a number of Australian dinosaurs and other Australian fossil animals known from single bones, and they're given a taxonomic name. It's hard to put something like that.
Work out what's what.
Yeah, especially when it's like just the proximal end of a femur or something like that, and that's given a scientific name. Like, how can you code half a bone into a phylogenetic matrix that has 120 characters of the entire skeleton?
Or how do you make sure that that femur isn't the same species as a hand bone? You don't, at the end of the day. Another kind of issue as well, I guess, is if Australia is part of the big southern supercontinent Gondwana and our neighbours are South America, Africa, Antarctica, and New Zealand, if we don't know a lot of the fossil record from eastern Gondwana, you know, New Zealand and Antarctica, well, it's hard to make sense of the family tree when you have so much missing.
Yeah, and I think it's only been recently, comparatively speaking, that the connections that Australia has with Mesozoic faunas from other parts of Gondwana, especially the dinosaur faunas, are very similar between Australia and South America. Is that the same with pterosaurs?
Yeah. Pterosaurs are also weird, though, because they can fly. I'm guessing temnospondyls can't fly.
No, that's one weird thing that they can't do. I could have just dropped a bombshell then and said, yeah, they could also fly. But no, they could swim, they could walk on land, they ate their babies, they did not fly.
Once this new temnospondyl is out, are you then completely done with the group, or are there maybe some more temnospondyl things for you to work on? You don't have to give anything specific away, but should we keep an eye out for more papers?
Yes, do keep an eye out. I'm going to be consistently working on this group now, hopefully for a long time. I've spent 4 years of my life getting to know them quite intimately. And so I'm not going to change groups again and go and work on dinosaurs all of a sudden. So yes, there are some more very exciting discoveries in Australian temnospondyl paleontology that will be forthcoming in the next little while. And if this one didn't excite you, then the next ones probably will.
I'm so excited for everyone to hear about this incredible discovery and all of the science that you've done on it. I think the media is going to absolutely eat it up. There just seems to be such a big appetite for paleontological discoveries across all the different groups that you can think of.
Yeah, we can chalk that up to a few reasons. Obviously, the people that came just before we started. So, for example, I worked on Lightning Ridge material for my master's, Lightning Ridge crocodile material. But the stuff that's come out of Lightning Ridge recently is all up to that team of people led by Phil Bell at UNE. We've got two new dinosaur species that have been named out of that stuff, a new crocodile species. So there's been a lot happening that's been generating a lot of public interest in paleontology in Australia again. And we're not seen as this barren wasteland where it's all flat and just have trilobites. Like, we have some cool vertebrate material too from the Mesozoic. So I count myself really lucky that I get to work on this stuff now. I haven't had to go out and dig up any of it. The material that I've worked on for my PhD has all been in museum collections. Yeah, I just count myself really lucky that people have come to me and see me as somebody who would hopefully do these amazing fossils justice in describing them and giving them a place in Australian paleontology.
It's very humbling to be approached by someone with an incredible fossil and be entrusted with the responsibility of describing it scientifically.
And both you and I have been really lucky that we've had that happen several times. You had it with Ferrodroco as well. It's just one of those things where you don't dream of these things happening, especially when you're a kid and you're growing up and you want to be a paleontologist. You don't think someone's going to just come with you with this amazing fossil. Say, hey, look, this is an amazing fossil, and now you can name it.
It's a fairy godmother moment, essentially, to be plucked out of obscurity and say, you're the one here, throw the ring into the volcano.
Yeah. Or, hey, there's this amazing fossil that's been in the museum collection for over 20 years that no one's described yet. Do you want to do a PhD on it?
There's definitely a component of being in the right place at the right time, but you also took the initiative to search around and ask about what potential projects that you could work on.
Absolutely. And we've all got to be motivated to get where we're at, right?
100%. We're not doing it because there's lots of money to be made. It's because we love doing it. And honestly, I can't imagine doing anything else with my life.
Yeah, absolutely. And like I said, it was a love that I had from when I was a kid. And yeah, hopefully discoveries like this can keep inspiring the next generation.
Yep. If anyone is building a retaining wall and sees something strange, contact your local museum. And if it turns out to be a weird, fanged, tusked, possibly toxic amphibian, you know who to call. But yeah, is there anything you wanted to plug other than come see this amazing fossil when it is finally put on public display?
Yep. Keep an eye on media that comes from the Australian Museum about when the fossil might come on display. Have a look at the paper when it is released. And by the time this podcast is released, the paper should also be out. So it's going to be in the Journal of Vertebrate Paleontology. And yeah, I hope that lots of people come and see the fossil and are excited by it like I am.
Lachlan, thank you so much for being on the show and telling us all about Arena Urpaton supinatus, as well as temnospondyls in general. I've learned so much about these ancient amphibians, and I cannot wait to see what new research you have on this amazing group of animals. If you want to be in the loop and find out when Arena Urpaton supinatus finally goes on display, follow the Australian Museum. I'm sure they'll make an announcement in their newsletter and on social media, so keep an eye out for that. Hope you enjoyed hearing about temnospondyls again. If I'd known they'd pop up again and again, I would have asked Jenny Zhao, who did the podcast cover art, to chuck one in there. But hey, who knows? Maybe I'll get her to revamp the cover art for the show and it'll feature the greatest hits and fossils from the episodes with the most downloads. By the way, if you love the podcast cover art, there's a sticker of that, as well as a giant sticker sheet with the different dig tools, animals, and fossils it features. You can find those in our online shop. Just go to palsinpaleo.com or check out the link in the show notes. If you want to support the show, but stickers aren't your thing or money's tight, that's cool too. If you enjoyed the show and want to help spread the word, leave a review and rating. It helps immensely. And it takes like not even a minute, but that helps the show rank higher. And then when people go to look for information on this stuff, they can find us more easily. The podcast wouldn't be what it is today without the help from Francie, who edits the show and also sings the theme song. He's super talented. You can find him on Instagram at HelloFrancie and keep up to date with his various projects. Otherwise, his band called Hello Kelly are worth a follow. In terms of the new bands I've gotten into over the last 5 or so years, they're one of my favorites. If you haven't already, go check out their album, Sweet Nostalgia. It's heartbreakingly good. There's guitars, there's synths, it has everything you could ever want from an indie pop rock album and more. Shout out to my buddy, Caesar Pushmaran. He helped me figure out what I was doing with the podcast when I first started and also edited our early episodes. He's phenomenal, super knowledgeable when it comes to frogs and birds, and his podcast, Death by Birding, is chaos, but there's heaps of good info too. So if you've binged the entire back catalogue of Pals and Paleo, definitely check out Death by Birding, but beware, it has swearing in it. The podcast cover art came together through the magic of Crumpet Clubhouse, a collective of freelance creatives co-founded by Jenny Zhao, who I mentioned before, and Amy Franks. Working with them was easy and effortless, and I'm still in love with the podcast cover art. Final thank you is yours. I couldn't do the show if no one was listening. It's been super fun connecting with people who love paleontology as much as I do and getting to share what I'm passionate about with folks who know about dinosaurs but aren't familiar with the stuff we find here in Australia. Fossils are these weird relics from past worlds, and getting to share facts on them is seriously one of my favorite things to do. So again, thank you for listening. It was the best of times, and it was the blurst of times. Pals in Paleo will be back soon to talk about new discoveries, about old fossils, but until then, just keep digging, look after yourself, and I'll speak to you soon.